Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, and welcome to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Big Bad Chef John Currents. Welcome.
Thanks, man. You guys scraped the bottom of the barrel, apparently.
Yeah, we're done. We've hit the whole spectrum, ran the gamut. That's why we had to call you in. That's bullshit. I mean, I'm holding a gorgeous new book that you're nominated for, a James Beard Award, Pickles, Pigs, and Whiskey. Your three favorite food groups. But what you have done in the South as far as a food revival or just making people aware of, you know, where food come from, what good food is, and how to share that with a community, I mean, I can't say enough about what you've done. So a big congratulations on that. You know, that's an accolade in it of itself.
Well, thanks. It's, you know, this has been a tremendous ride for me. It's been a, you know, the last 30 years have been a really amazing time to be involved in Southern food, because we've sort of come from complete and total obscurity or, you know, comedy, you know, to a point where, you know, we've really been granted some credibility with food, and, you know, folks have taken a good hard look at it and, you know, and really understand sort of how important it is and how relevant it is to, you know, the story of food in the United States. And so to have been there and on that ride, you know, literally in the kitchen with Bill Neal 30 years ago, you know, to, you know, sort of holding hands with guys like Louis Osteen and Frank Stitt as a young man, to, you know, walking on my own. And then, you know, and now, you know, into the years where I'm going to need a walker and, you know, and watching the guys who, you know, come to this and, you know, are really, really, you know, hitting the afterburner and showing off. It's great.
You said comedic. I want to kind of explore what that means. What was Southern food looked, you know, how did it project itself 30 years ago?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it existed and, you know, it was very much there, but, you know, the general perception, you know, was that it was fried and it was unhealthy and it was bad for you. And, you know, it wasn't, you know, worth really giving a thought. And I think at the same time, though, you know, we weren't really looking hard at the, you know, the history of regional food, you know, in the United States either. You know, we were, you know, chefs were, you know, were reaching back towards Western Europe more often than not. You know, you were seeing some guys, you know, sort of lean towards Asia. But we were really sort of trying to, you know, sort of fiddle with the grand cuisine and reference those things. And, you know, in the last three decades, you know, we really have started to look at regional food in the United States. And, you know, I mean, and not to, you know, to put anyone else down, but the South has got such an incredible history to it. And this food, you know, tells the story, you know, of that particular area of the country, which is the, you know, the agrarian just breadbasket of the country, and, you know, and has just dozens of these different, you know, ethnic communities and immigrant populations that settled there and created this insanely huge canon of food. So, you know, we're looking at that there now. Folks have taken cue from that, and you're seeing it happen in Texas. You're seeing it happen in the Southwest and, you know, the Northeast. I mean, folks are really sort of looking more inward now than looking outward for inspiration, I think.
You put a flag in Oxford, Mississippi, but where were you born and raised, and what did you bring with you, even, you know, to your restaurants there?
Well, I was born and raised in New Orleans, and so you know, I obviously, you know, you're born with a fork and knife, and you know, and a double old fashioned glass in your hand when you exit the birth canal. So you know, food was a big part of life, and my family's from the Carolinas, and my mom's family were farmers. And so I spent a lot of time, you know, in the family garden in the summers with them. So, you know, I saw the food of the sort of the grand Creole French tradition in New Orleans, traditional French. I saw the food of my grandmother's Sunday supper table, which was sort of as patently Deep South, as it gets. And then, you know, I also had the opportunity as a youngster to live in Western Europe, in the UK, in the early 70s. And so, we traveled a lot, and I actually, you know, saw the classic dishes of Western Europe, you know, in the places that that they originated, and so, you know, I had a tremendous experience with food, and while I tell folks it makes a great story for a chef in the making, and I never really had any sort of grand desire or grand plan to get into food. Sort of through my life, it just sort of happened. And, you know, when I ended up in Oxford, in 92, I guess I'd been in the business for, approaching, 8 or 10 years. And I didn't have any business opening a restaurant. I mean, although, there are not a lot of guys at, 25, 26 years old that do have any business opening a restaurant, but I didn't have any idea what, I was trying to express through my food or that I even was supposed to. And so, when I arrived in Oxford, it was very fortuitous because it was a town that needed something. It didn't want too much, so I didn't have to overreach my abilities, as a young chef. And so I really, had the opportunity to grow up very slowly and very honestly. And, my, story matured sort of through those years as I, began to understand, what it was that, was my passion and ultimately, were the stories that I was trying to tell through my food.
See, do you remember that first menu at a City Grocery in Oxford, Mississippi? Because I think it's really interesting that you have gumbo on the menu now, and even a Southerner would be like, "What's gumbo doing in Oxford?" You being a Louisiana boy, New Orleans, bring that over seemed like far reach.
Well, you have to understand, Mississippi is a sort of a strange place because. We spend a lot of time sort of doing culinary archaeology. Mississippi doesn't have, a whole lot of definable foodways, and they take a lot of cue, from the Gulf Coast and from New Orleans specifically, and in Oxford, particularly, which is 325 or 50 miles from New Orleans, you see it. I think because there's a connection between, New Orleans and the university, there's a lot of traffic going back and forth and always has been. So, the food of New Orleans is not entirely out of place there, nor is it in Memphis, even another hour north of us. New Orleans food is, no matter who you talk to or, the reality is it is an undeniable, sort of force of nature. And it's wonderful food. And, that when you talk about gumbo specifically, that's one of those sort of incredible kind of peasant food dishes. And it's everybody has their own recipe. You can put anything in it, and it's entirely subject to interpretation. And to the point where, there's a recipe in the book for a red beans and rice gumbo, which, one of my very dearest friends and one of the smartest people in the world, Lolas Eli. Who wrote a book called Smokestack Lightning. He was a tour manager for Wynton Marsalis. He wrote for Treme and the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. Just will absolutely slap me down, to say, if it's got beans in it, it's not gumbo, period. And I'm like, but that's a great thing about gumbo. It's all about interpretation. And so, I think, you kind of have a difficult time trying to pull Mississippi and New Orleans food apart. They just sort of coexist. And so that made it a very easy transition for me.
Where's Dookie Chase?
It's so deep in my heart that I don't want to share it. You mean sort of where is it in its history, or you know, where is it located?
Where is it located, and why is Holy Thursday so important?
It is so important. I mean, for one reason and one reason alone to me, and that is because Leah Chase is maybe the most divine spirit on the planet. And I was just telling somebody the other night, and one of my Leah is, for those who don't know, is the grand dame of Creole cuisine in New Orleans, and her restaurant is one of the, I think, most important cultural institutions in the country. You know, Leah is just this personality that's almost, you know, beyond explanation. You know, I sort of equate her to the Pope. And I don't mean that in sort of a comical way. I mean, her spirit is so huge. I was telling somebody recently that I was on my way to New Orleans to meet Sean Brock, and Sean arrived a couple hours before me, and we were texting, and he was asking me what he should do for lunch. And I said, I'll tell you exactly what to do. You get your ass in a car and go straight over to Dookie Chase and walk back in the kitchen, and Leah Chase is going to be sitting in a chair, and you go up to her and you take her hand and tell her that you're my friend and I sent you there, and she'll feed you some of the best fried chicken you've ever had. And I said, and if you don't come away from just that handshake, you know, a changed man, there's something profoundly wrong with you. And so I got off the plane, and my phone was ringing, and I picked it up, and it was Sean, and he was going, dude, I cried. She hugged me, and I cried. And that's, you know, and that's not melodramatic. I mean, she's just that big a person. And, you know, and she's so important, Liz. I think about, I was going to turn 92 this year, but I mean, she has been at the center of, you know, the vortex of race and politics in New Orleans. You know, she has kept this tradition of African American art and Creole food, you know, alive on that corner on Orleans Boulevard. And you know, it's really a very, very important place, and it's the place, you know, I think that everybody who is into food needs to visit, you know, at least once, and hopefully before she's gone.
See, this is what I love, is that you have this reverence for somebody else. To put that in the head note of a recipe saying, I have this gumbo, but what you really have to do is go to Dookie Chase on Holy Thursday, meet this woman, and experience that, you know, it's similar to your role with Southern Foodways Alliance. You know, sitting on the board of directors, you care so much inherently about the people, the politics, you know, the ethnicities, the race, the culture, that it's not just, you know, pickles, pigs, and whiskey.
Yeah, it's relationships. And I mean, and that's the bottom line. And, you know, I think there are a lot of folks who, you know, look at this, you know, sort of body of Southern chefs, and, you know, we're sort of suspect to a lot of folks, because, you know, this is an industry that, you know, and you go in some places and it's very cutthroat and it's competitive, and, you know, the relationships, you know, exist in a very different sort of way. They're competitive. For us, you know, we truly love one another. I mean, and respect one another. And, you know, it's like I tell folks all the time, you know, I love to hate Mike Latta. He makes the most divine chicken liver mousse or chicken liver pate that you'll ever have in your entire life. And it's one of those things that everybody throws their guns down, you know, when it comes to trying to recreate it or do something like it. It's like, Mike's done that. He owns it. Nobody else will touch it. But if you ask him about it, he'll walk you through the process. He'll give you the recipe. He'll come into the kitchen with you and show you exactly how he does it. It's like, we don't have these crazy secrets from one another. You know, we want to share. You know, to me, you know, the greatest thing in the world is Mike, and I have to go back to Mike, but I mean, we were in Atlanta and doing a meal a couple of years ago, and I was, you know, sort of getting my course together, and he came over and stuck his finger in the pot, and then went over and got his sous chef, Jason, by the ear, and came over and said, that's what oxtail ought to taste like every time it gets made. I want that recipe. And, you know, and to me, that's not one of those things. It's like, you know, my response is like, I've got it figured out now. And, you know, and I have a great secret. You know, it's like, that's the most flattering thing in the world that can happen to a guy. And I, you know, and I want to share with him. And so, you know, we have a great time together. It's not that, you know, that that all of the relationships are without complication, but there is this great, healthy, wonderful respect for one another and joy of being together. And so we have a different relationship, and we try to, to foster that in folks, and I hope it follows suit, because, food is so much about sharing and about relationships and joy. And so, that just carries through for us.
See, it's even more flattering that you're here today, willing to share that with us. On top of it, sharing your recipes in pickles, pigs, and whiskey. We're going to take a quick break. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We'll be right back.
White Oak Pastures is the only farm in the United States that has its own USDA-inspected red meat abattoir or slaughterhouse and its own USDA-inspected poultry abattoir or slaughterhouse. We partner with Whole Foods to deliver our high-quality meat and poultry from Miami, Florida, all the way to Princeton, New Jersey. One family, one farm, five generations, 145 years. A full circle return to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. For more information, please visit our website, whiteoakpastures.com.
Hey, and welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm Michael Harlan Turkel here with John Currents. Let's just talk about music, since that's what we were kind of talking about during the break. You walked in, and what were they blasting on the radio?
The Jam, man. Paul Weller was right in my left ear when I came in. It was awesome.
I think it's such an important thing to note that in this cookbook itself, to appropriately, make these recipes, you have to have a drink made and in hand.
At least one.
At least one. And you have to have the music on.
Yeah, those things, they go so incredibly well together. And, to me, they don't come apart. It's interesting to me, that I do have close friends that, their kitchens are dead silent. It's, it's very serious. And, and I don't hold that against John Besh. But I don't understand it. To me, it's like, and it doesn't have to be, Ride the Lightning, at full volume. It can be, Mozart or Bach or, it can be Burt Bacharach. That there's just something about these two things that are so intertwined. And, and I was talking to the guys in Sugarland last week. And that was a name drop, by the way. I did an event with them, and I had no idea who they are, because I'm like 100 now, and so all of a sudden these guys are playing this event, and it turns out they're a big deal, and they're really swell guys on top of everything else. But we were talking about how the creative is sort of universal. And that, songs themselves, because they have words, do obviously tell a story. And that, so music is very much a personal expression and storytelling. But, food is in very much the same way. And it's, and I know it sounds kind of odd to say, but, when we create and when it becomes a very natural process, dishes that you come up with, you are sharing a part of your life. There's a reason that you put these ingredients together. And whether it's, sort of referencing a dish that your mom or grandmother made, or, something that you enjoyed somewhere, that you're trying to take something and experience in your life and share that with the person who's eating it, whether it's at your house or, as a chef in a restaurant. And so that, these two things are really woven together in that way.
I mean, was there music being played in your mother's and your grandmother's kitchen while food was on the stove?
Yeah, I think there, you know, there always was. I mean, I remember, you know, my grandmother's house, the, you know, as a real youngster, I remember my grandfather playing Johnny Cash, you know, live from Folsom Prison. You know, that really, you know, is one that jumps out in my head. You know, my mom was a big Moody Blues fan. And so I remember Darkness on the Threshold of a Dream and, you know, the early Beatles records, with Cat Stevens was, you know, sort of on when we were in the kitchen with mom. But, you know, these are the things that just, like, they jump out, you know, for me. But, yeah, I mean, just I don't remember a time when there wasn't, you know, music with food. And so the playlist that, you know, that I created to go along with the recipes in the book was, you know, it's really total kitsch. You know, I won't, you know, lie for a second. And part of it was really sort of meant to be an, you know, an irreverent kind of thumb in the eye to, you know, these cookbooks that I remember as a youngster coming up with and looking at. And, you know, each one had a wine paired with each. And you were supposed to go out and procure your 64 Aubryon. And, you know, to me, I felt like it seemed a little pretentious. And, you know, and I kind of feel like a dick now because... you know, I do have, you know, several friends who really do care about wine or have sommeliers that, you know, they've included in their books to, you know, but I mean, if you look at that book, it's like, if I'd paired wines with the recipes in there, you know, I'd have been run out of town. It's, you know, it'd have been a joke. So, you know, I wanted to, you know, to pair music. And so folks ask me all the time, sort of like, what's the connection with each song and each recipe? And, you know, it's not, you know, any sort of demonic code or, you know, there's no reason.
Like you can't play it backwards and figure out some secret recipe.
It's a cryptex, yeah. You know, it's, I know where the Holy Grail is.
Yeah. But I mean, let's go through, it doesn't have to be specific recipe by recipe, song by song. But I mean, when you make your steamed syrup braised pork belly, what do you want to be listening to? Or is there music that inspires you to make that dish?
You know, it's, music and mood is sort of entirely momentary. You know, to me, you know, cooking really is, you know, a joyful pastime. And, you know, and I don't just say that because it's what I do for a living and, you know, and what have you, or it sounds good. I mean, I truly enjoy it. I mean, you know, there's nothing in the world that I, you know, that I quite love, like, you know, making dinner for my wife. You know, and not just because I can't make anything that she doesn't like unless I pick an ingredient that she just patently detests. But you know, I think it's because I'm, you know, I'm such a sort of weird self-loathing Catholic that, you know, that the immediate gratification that you get from sharing something with someone that they like is, you know, is very satisfying, and it's, you know, it's validating. And, and, you know, for me, it's like, I enjoy the process. I don't see it as work. I mean, it's not every day is easy, you know, by any means, but, you know, I just don't look at it as work. I, you know, I look at it as, you know, it's fun. I enjoy the process. I, you know, I enjoy the end result. You know, it's harder now, you know, working that shit off, you know, than it was when I was 25, but, you know, I love it.
Yeah, I mean, but you also say that healthy living, you know, is not about cutting out fried chicken.
Yeah, I mean, it's the sexiest diet in the world is one that, you know, they'll never publish a book on. I mean, I shouldn't say the sexiest, the most honest diet is the one that they'll never write a book on, and it's called moderation. It's just that simple. I mean, you know, we need to exercise more. You know, we're getting more and more sedentary all the time. You know, and I say that, you know, living in a college town, you know, there's lots of exercise. I was really amazed in Austin, last week to see, you know, just how many people are out at, you know, at 7 a.m. on the streets running and walking. And so, you know, I think we are definitely moving in another direction, but, you know, you shouldn't have to deny yourself things. You know, in order to, you know, to live well, you know, it's, you know, life is, and relationships are all compromised. And so, you know, if you're going to eat well, you've got to pay for it on the other end.
And so, why would you deny yourself pimento cheese, hush puppies, barbecue shrimp, quail and waffle? I mean, it's ridiculous to not have that a part of your life.
Do you realize how cruel this is? I mean, to sit here and just throw those things around, and we're so close to that pizza oven in there, and I know how good what comes out of it is. It's kind of cruel.
Yeah, because the wetter the mouth, the more salivation, the better you sound on air.
Yeah.
But, I mean, talk about that food, but talk about doing everything right and from scratch. I love that you again, have an ode to somebody else, Duke's Mayonnaise, and how good that mayonnaise is. But you offer a recipe as well, still citing that Duke's may have some kind of drugs in it.
I haven't been contacted by their lawyers yet, but I also haven't gotten a chuckle out of them over that either, but... Yeah, you know, I think one of the things that, you know, as we progress down the road that, you know, that I really got more and more serious about doing, and it really perplexes my guys. It's like when there is something, you know, that I will sort of expound upon, you know, how wonderful it is, like Tabasco hot sauce. But then immediately, we're sourcing fresh Tabasco peppers and trying to make our own. They're like, well, why, if you like this stuff so much, do you want to make it? And, you know, and my, I guess my, you know, my, there's a sort of a running joke around our house when I was a kid that, my folks used to like keep a stopwatch on me on Christmas morning so that, you know, they could time how long it was between when I would open a present to when I got a screwdriver, a butter knife out and started taking it apart to see how it worked. And so I've always been fascinated with trying to, you know, to recreate things. And, you know, because there's a story to that where, you know, Tabasco is great, but ordering it off of the truck and having it delivered and putting it on the table is one thing. And there's no story that goes along with that other than the history of that bottle. You know, but being able to say, okay, we really like that, but we wanted to try to do it ourselves and approximate something. And we'll never recreate Tabasco, but we now make, you know, a dozen different kinds of hot sauce as a result of our interest in the fermentation process and, you know, sourcing different peppers. And so we have all these different options and different stories to tell that go along with them.
Yeah, I feel like it's not one of those like, oh, I do it because I do everything DIY. It's part of that break, too, from that almost French cuisine tradition of you do something this way, you know, this is how you make a Mornay. This is, and you never really experimented. You didn't have your own cooking language, and trying to deconstruct or reconstruct Tabasco is saying, well, that company has been around for what, 100 years at least.
Oh yeah. Easily way longer.
Why can't we, you know, fuck around with it a little bit? Why can't we change things and see if we can make it better? And maybe we can't, but at least try.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just, it's all about, I think, you know, ultimately a greater respect for, you know, that thing that you use. I mean, if you sit there and, you know, rather than just, you know, buy it from the store and put it on the table, you know, you're actually taking it apart and seeing what it is and, you know, and recreating it with ingredients that are your own and have a terroir that is, you know, that is, you know, is relevant and, you know, and has story behind it, then, you know, again, there's a better story to tell and you can charge more for it.
Let's talk about catfish because I think it's in the same vein. It's something that is widely, you know, misunderstood in the States, but you kind of, you know, put it on a pedestal. You think it's a great ingredient. Why and what should people be doing with catfish that they don't do already?
Well, you know, we're fortunate because, you know, by virtue of our, you know, geographic location, we can get our hands on, you know, on catfish straight out of the pond. You know, the process of farm raising catfish is something that is, you know, continued to evolve and improve, you know, over, you know, the last 50 or 60 years. And, you know, catfish is a, you know, is an, you know, is a sustainable, you know, ingredient or protein from, you know, where we're from that, you know, I'm an advocate of, you know, making as much use of, you know, anything that is, you know, as local as that is to us. You know, it is misunderstood because, you know, just like everything else, you know, where I'm really sort of at the end of the generation of guys that, you know, still sort of, you know, struggle with seafood and, you know, and eating seafood, you know, at inland locations. Because when I was a kid, you know, freezing, you ate seafood when you went to the beach, because the, you know, the freezing techniques were crude, and you know, there was a lot of spoilage, there was a lot of freezer burn, you know, frozen stuff was, you know, it's not treated the way that it is now, and so just there wasn't a quality to it, you know, that there is today. And you know, now it's totally sci-fi. You know, you can have a piece of tuna that's 6 months old that, you know, that you're cutting into sashimi, you know, if it's, you know, hit with liquid nitrogen and frozen properly and slacked properly. And, you know, most folks are never going to know the difference between that and fresh. And, you know, and maybe I'm stretching a little bit, but, you know, the point is it's, you know, it's a different ball game now. Catfish is something that, you can get here, that, you know, in New York, that's, you know, as good as you'll get, you know, in Mississippi. And it's just an ingredient that has a stigma about it, just like lard, just like, you know, any number of things that we could talk about that's totally unfounded. And that, you know, when you open yourself to it and you play with it, and it's like all of a sudden it's, you know, it's this thing that, you know, you didn't realize was there, and, you know, and it's fun. And, you know, and right now, you know, more importantly than anything else is, it's inexpensive. And, you know, we're seeing a sort of a gross spike in the cost of proteins now across the board for any number of reasons. I mean, beef is up, pork is up dramatically, and Smithfield's been sold, and, you know, we're pretty sure we're never going to see, you know, $1 a pound pork ever again, which is something that's, you know, it's a little bit frightening if, you know, you're dealing with the volume that we are. So, you know, finding these things that are worth celebrating, that you know, are cost friendly, is, you know, is important.
You talk about costs, and I kind of want to be honest about those costs, because as much as a restaurant is a business, you also have one that is in the business of being a nonprofit, and the importance of giving back. You know, as a restaurateur, as someone that is, you know, a figure of the community and of, you know, the Southern world, how important is it to have some place like Lamar Lounge, and what do you do?
Well, you know, it's funny. This is nothing that, you know, is anybody ever sat me down and, you know, and said, well, this is the way that it is. It has just always been, you know, a part of my, you know, personal belief system that, and maybe it has to do with, you know, the studying philosophy in college, or, you know, what have you. You know, I love my liberal arts education, but it's, you know, it's made me very sensitive.
it's good to see a chef that can emote.
I've just always felt like, you know, that there was an inherent responsibility that I had to, you know, give back to the community that I'm lucky enough to make a living from. I mean, we do our best to take care of our people. I mean, on paper, you know, I am a train wreck. And my accountant just can't figure me out, because, you know, they're in the business of, you know, sort of securing the bottom line as much as possible. And I'm just sort of willy-nilly. Like, I don't care. As long as I can buy diapers and, you know, get my wife a pair of shoes, and, you know, we can keep the air conditioner running in the summer, you know, I kind of don't care, as long as my people are taken care of, you know, that the folks in the community know that, you know, that we're there to participate. You know, otherwise you just look like these, you know, opportunist robber barons that are, you know, there to just sort of fleece folks. And I think that's sort of particularly true, you know, or germane to, you know, to our business, which is about nourishing. You know, we're nourishing the community. So, you know, I think the inspiration for Lamar Lounge, the philosophical, you know, is entirely the result of my very dear friend Ashley Christensen, who is one of the greatest people in the entire world. She has a pile of restaurants in Raleigh, North Carolina, and is one of the most talented people that I know. And we decided, over about 10 gallons of bourbon last summer while we were up here, actually, that we wanted to do this barbecue project together. We had the opportunity to get our hands, or I had the opportunity to get my hands on the Lamar Lounge in Oxford. I'd always wanted to do an excuse to do barbecue. And there was an opportunity to do that, and we could do it together, but use this, you know, the space and the money that we earned from it to give back entirely at the end of the year to a charity. And we could never make it work where, you know, she's in North Carolina, I'm in Mississippi, that, you know, we were going to make this barbecue thing work together. But it was really, you know, the brainchild of, you know, of Ashley and Bourbon and me in Midtown. So, you know, we do operate this thing now as a not-for-profit. You know, at the end of the year, you know, we at the beginning of the year, we'll select a charity. Hopefully, you know, we'll continue to do something that involves children and nutrition. And at the end of the year, you know, we'll take whatever's left over and, you know, that we've earned. And that goes wadded up in an envelope to whoever it is that we've decided to give it to. And it feels good. And, you know, the folks who, you know, patronize a restaurant, you know, can feel good about the fact that, you know, they're contributing to something, you know, and it's fun because the place really has this, you know, this really kind of crazy good spirit to it. It's not the kind of thing that we wear on our sleeves. It's not plastered on the side of the building. It's not written on the menu anywhere. It just is, and it feels good, and it's a nice place, and it's a lot of fun, and it has a really cool bar that used to belong to Eddie Fisher.
Can you believe that all this came from learning how to make a roux, slathering, pickling, brining, all these techniques that you have in this cookbook, that from that foundation you're able to give back and celebrate, you know, food traditions, community, and music?
Yeah, I mean, no doubt. It's all about passion, you know, and that's where, you know, I think, you know, all the arts, and I'm hesitant to talk about food as an art, you know, but it is, you know, but that's where, you know, I think great things happen is, you know, as a result of, you know, of those passions, and that's what this is for me, and that's, you know, sort of why this vulgar little book you're holding is, you know, has come out the way that it has, because that's me, you know, that's entirely me in that book, and it's taken, you know, 30 years to arrive there, but you know, that is sort of my heart and soul in 150 recipes in that book.
Pickles, pigs, and whiskey. John Kearns, thank you so much for being on Heritage.
Thanks, brother.
You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan-Turkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.